Thank you. Hi, good morning. It is very much a pleasure to speak at Blue Hat. My name is Stefano. Many of you maybe have seen me speaking at Black Hat because I've recognized many faces this morning while walking through the halls. It's a real pleasure to address the people from Microsoft because I feel that what you guys are doing for implementing and building security into some of the world's most used products is extremely valuable. So I'm not saying this out, you know, of just a homage or an empty set of words. It's really a pleasure to be able to address you. What I would like to introduce to you today is something that maybe is a bit far from what you usually do. Some of you I know work in malware analysis and in threat intelligence, but many of you maybe are less aware of these subjects. So for those that are more familiar, bear with me if sometimes I introduce some concepts because I don't know if all of the audience knows about those. So this is a concept that I think most people working in security or even just working in computing nowadays know about, right? One of the significant problems that we have currently on the internet is the fact that there are attackers, there are people that make a lot of money, a lot of profit from running botnets. Botnets are networks of compromised devices. We used to say compromised computers. That's not really true anymore. They can be different types of devices. They are networks of compromised devices that an attacker, who will be in our slides represented by a pirate, is able to use to make a lot of money. And most of the money that these people running botnets make comes from the number of devices that they have been able to infect and the persistence of those devices in their network. They are not just interested in taking over control of a device and extracting some information occasionally from it, but they are interested in keeping control of that device for a long time. So one of the things that we have focused on over the years as analysts is how these people keep control of those devices. So basically, we have focused on the idea of targeting the command and control channel used to pilot those devices. And of course, since this is an adversarial system, the bot owners, bot masters, have also focused on protecting their command and control channels, because that's where their money comes from, the ability to command bots and to receive data back. So since their command and control channel used to be their single point of failure, they have developed what they call rallying mechanisms, different ways to have all of those bots connect back to a single point of command. Rallying mechanisms are very different. They used to be very simple, like hard coding a domain name or an IP address inside the malware, but this entails a lot of problem, right? Because in the defense world, we can take those resources away from the bot masters. We can sync call IP addresses. If someone is using an IP address for some malicious purposes, unless it's on some, shall we say, well-known malicious hosters, it is nowadays a matter of hours to sync call that address, to take away that address from the attacker. And the same happens even if with a slightly longer delay for taking away domain names. So what the malicious attackers came up with was the idea of basically not using something encoded inside their malware. And this is pretty much what we are dealing with on with this research that we named Phoenix and Cerberus. Domain generation is one way not to encode any information in your malware. Basically, it works like this. And once again, sorry for those that are already aware of these terms, but I really need to bring all of the people in the audience up to speed. It works like this. Instead of hard coding information in the malware author inserts in the malware an algorithm that generates random strings of domain names from a seed that is not predictable, but it's easily reachable. It could be date and time, but more often on internet-connected computers is a seed that can be gathered from some website. Headlines of newspapers, it could be Twitter trending topics, whatever you can get to with a very simple API call. From that seed, a long list of random or pseudo-random domain names is generated. The bot owner registers one of these domain names. They can be 10,000, 50,000 per day. They choose just one. All of the bots try all of the domain names until they get to the right one. So basically, the bots will go ahead and query random domain names a number of times, getting NX domain replies. And at some point, they will hit the right domain. And at that point, they will have found the command and control server. For that day, week, whatever, this is usually in most botnets, it happens daily, but it could have different time frames. So the end result is that every day, the bot master needs to register one of these domains before the defenders can sync call all of them. And this turns the race against us. Also, since this happens every day, and since the generation is not really predictable ahead of time, the race starts again every morning. And every day that the bot master is able to get his domain before us, is able to control the botnet, and maybe to update it, maybe to change the domain generation algorithm. So the next day, instead of just running behind him, we run behind him twice. We need to discover and understand the domain generation algorithm and to register the domain names before him. This is a losing game for the defenders. It's also a very difficult game for protecting networks. So it basically creates an asymmetry between bot master and defenders, and it tosses out blacklisting or sinkholing, which were the traditional ways to take down a command and control channel. Now, of course, I am not the first. My research group is not the first to study this this problem, and several other researchers. I would just mention the research by Roberto Perdici, who is at Georgia Tech, have focused on the problem, with the idea of saying, okay, let's see how we can detect that there are clients on my network, on my corporate network, for instance, that are infected by one of these bots. And Roberto came up with a very interesting and very simple observation. And the observation is this. Nowadays, how many times do you actually physically type a domain name? It happens rarely, 5-4 times per day, 10 times per day. Sometimes you type an address. Most of the times, if you are typing a domain name, it's because you are typing an email address. People do not really type domain names that much in the browser anymore. But in any case, how many times per day can you get a domain name wrong? 4 times, 5 times, 10 times, maybe more if you are particularly literate with computers. But come on, nobody gets it wrong 10,000 times per day. Hopefully. Sorry, Mom, maybe you could, actually. But so if a client receives tens of thousands of NX domains replies, it's a client that is infected with one of these botnets. That's a very simple observation and very powerful. You can actually pretty much sort out all clients that are infected by one of the these botnets, even if you don't know about the botnet yet. But there's a significant limit to this. And the significant limit is that this works only if you own and control the network. If you are working on a corporate network, this works. If you are working on defending a university network, this works. If you are working at a service provider, this works for finding out your customers that are affected. If you are Google, for instance, and you are running or OpenDNS, and you are running a widely used DNS service, it works. But in general, it doesn't work because you cannot share data of resolution of names along with client IP addresses. If you are used at doing threat intelligence, one of the powerful tools we use is passive DNS data, right? Feeds of resolutions of names to IP addresses in the past. But those feeds do not have the client information. They only have the resolution information. And if you are doing threat intelligence, you can have access to very good feeds of passive DNS data, but you cannot really have access to very good feeds of non-anonymized DNS resolution data. Once again, unless you are Google or OpenDNS. Those are the two largest feeds of DNS data. And in fact, OpenDNS does a lot of this stuff on their data sets. So the limit of the approaches that our colleagues came up with is that they work only if you have visibility of the client IP addresses. There are also other approaches that do not require that, but they are mostly supervised. They require you to give to the approach a sample of the data. What we wanted to come up with was a way to automatically infer the existence of a new botnet, of a new DGA botnet, or a new algorithm for a DGA botnet, directly from the DNS resolution data that is available to everybody. Well, not to everybody, but to most people. So we came up with two different systems, which are one the evolution of the other. The first one is called Phoenix, and basically, Phoenix works to create this. Figure out from a list of domains that are already known to be used by malicious users, which ones are likely to be automatically generated. So the fruit of a domain generation algorithm. How does it do that? It does that by basically taking up a source of malicious domains. Those are the two most famous sources that we make use of that you can also use for your experiments in the future if you want to play with these things. Exposure is an academic project, and the malware domain list instead is a community-run project. So you can get very good feeds of malicious domains from there. And then we asked of ourselves, okay, how do we tell if something is a DGA or not? And it turns out to be a very interesting problem where basically you can make use of a couple of features to understand this. The first feature is that automatically generated domains, such as the one on the right, are unlikely to contain human words, meaningful words. So for instance, the domain is Facebook. I purposefully avoided to use Microsoft, which is pretty much a demonstration of the contrary, which is you can have a non-malicious, non-DGA domain that does not really contain an English word. Well, micro is an English word, depending on the dictionary that you have. But you get my meaning. Not all domain names, not all even non-malicious domain names contain human words. For instance, the domain name of my university is PolyMe. If I used an English dictionary, I don't think there is even a couple of characters that belong to a dictionary word. So this is obviously not the only thing that you can look at, because otherwise you would say that PolyMe, for instance, is malicious. It's a domain automatically generated. You can resort to n-gram popularity. This is actually a much better metric. In words that are chosen to be pronounceable, and pronounceable, of course, depends on the language, but in general, most of the languages on Earth have couples, d-grams, that are completely unlikely to happen. And this is still an example. So the non-word on the right, which is something like arc, is completely unpronounceable. If you even try to pronounce it, you don't even know how to do that. Because some of those sequences, in particular RQ and QV, in English are completely not present. If I were using Italian, RQ can happen in Italian, but QV cannot happen in Italian either. I cannot think of a language except maybe Finnish and Norwegian where QV are a valid sequence. So if I see a sequence like that, it is very unlikely to come from a human, humanly generated domain. Because when you choose a domain, usually, not always, but usually, you want it to be easy to remember. That's the only reason for registering a domain, right? Otherwise, we would be typing IP addresses. So, and some of us do, actually. So it's very likely that the domain on the right is automatically generated. Now, let me just say in advance that this is, of course, biased. I am looking at DNS data from European and American data feeds mostly. If I were looking at data coming from different regions of the world, this could very well not hold. But the wide majority of the domain names that are registered to be international on the internet. And so in most cases, they adhere to words that are pronounceable according to the English pronunciation. But if we wanted to run this, for instance, on domain names registered in China or in Japan, we might have to do different choices than d-grams. So n-grams, 1 grams, 2 grams in particular, or 3 grams, this reasoning you can repeat also for 3 grams, are a very powerful way to discriminate automatically generated from humanly generated. All of these features that I have told you about, n-grams belonging to the dictionary, they can be used for clustering things into humanly and non-humanly generated. Now, 1 grams, 2 grams, 3 grams, percentage of the word that is made up of dictionary words. This is already 4 dimensions. I don't know about you, but I personally am unable to see in 4 dimensions. And most humans, I would say, are unable to see in 4 dimensions. So for the benefit of us all, I reduce these 4 dimensions to a 2-dimensional plot. This is a technique that data scientists know very well. It's called principal component analysis. It's a projection. So the image that I'm showing, this image, is a projection of a 4-dimensional space. But actually, in a 4-dimensional space, it is very much the same. There is a hyperdimensional egg of domains that are humanly generated according to these characteristics. Whatever falls outside of this egg, outside of that ellipse that you see over there, is very likely to be automatically generated. The further you go, the more likely it is. So you can see three bands in that graph. One band, which is the ellipse, is the very likely humanly generated data. One band, which is in purple, it is the band. This is a graphic that is not very good for colorblind, so apologies for that. But in the purple band, there is things that could be automatically generated or not. In the blue band, there's things that are really, really difficult to pronounce. Now, does this mean that those things are automatically malicious? No, but in fact, we started from a feed of malicious domains. So we know that they are malicious even before being automatically generated. Does that mean that those things are for sure automatically generated? Not really. There are domains that are humanly generated and that break all the rules that we have mentioned. I have one example. Most of you maybe know Hack in the Box. It's a very famous security conference. It's happening next week in Kuala Lumpur. If you are going to be there, come say hi. I will be there, or my corpse will be there, depending on the adjustment to the time zones and jet lag. Hack in the Box has a domain name as hitb.org, which is not chosen by a human, according to our algorithm. It is an acronym. Acronyms can fall outside that area. But we are doing this for intelligence. We are not doing this for malware detection. We are not going to block something. So we don't care about those. As long as those false positives are limited, we don't really care about those. Also, because this is just the first step of processing, then we go ahead. Let me skip this. Then we go ahead and pick up those automatically generated domain names, or rather, those domain names that seem to be automatically generated. And I remind you, they are malicious because we took them from malicious domain lists. And we cluster them together according to their language features, so to the structure of the names, with the same features that I just mentioned, and according to the fact that they have or have not resolved to the same IP address. So in this graph that you see over there, I have all the dots are domain names. Wherever you see a connection between two dots, an edge in that graph, it means that those two domain names in the past have resolved to the same IP address. The huge ball, tangled ball of domain names that you see over there, the one with green lines around it, the green circle around it, is Zeus. And it comes up automatically out of the analysis of the names. I have not told my system, look, this is a sample of Zeus, find something like this. This comes up automatically, it emerges from the analysis of the sequence of domain. The other botnet in green could be Palivo. I don't recall at the moment. It's another botnet, it's very well connected. Then at some point, that botnet shifted to another IP address. You can see that because there are those dots connected to the other cluster of dots that are more closely related to each other. And those outliers around there, they are, well, they may be botnets for which we have seen just a few resolutions, so we don't have enough of those to cluster them, or they may be those false positives I was talking about. They do not group with other automatically generated looking like domain names. Okay, so this is an example of results. If you run Phoenix for a few days, for a week, on a stream of DNS resolutions, you will end up with clusters that look like these. Phoenix will tell you, okay, there's these two IP addresses, and there's this string of domain names that have been generated by the same automatic domain name generator, which probably are the same botnet. And in our case, we were able, we basically used older DNS data, and we were able to track back those clusters and those IP addresses to their botnets. So we were able to verify that the intelligence gathered from the system was actually correct. That's one of the problems. When you build an intelligence system, you don't know how to validate it, right? So the only way that you have to validate a system that extracts intelligence is by making it extract intelligence on data that is older. So on that data, you already have verified results that you can match to the intelligence you extracted. And the other, those are two clusters, for example, but Phoenix will extract hundreds of clusters, actually, according to different types of botnets. And one of the interesting things that happened was that we were not looking for it, but what one of the interesting things that happened was that by looking at the results from Phoenix over time, we were able to actually see the botnets shifting from autonomous system to autonomous system, and we were able to map some of these shifts with takedown operations. So we connected back with friends in the malware analysis community, and we said, okay, we saw this botnet moving from here to here. And someone says, oh, okay, that was me. I shut down their operations over there, and they moved elsewhere. And it's an interesting additional feature that Phoenix demonstrated. So we were able to validate it in this way. Of course, Phoenix has also one huge gap. And the huge gap is this. Basically, when Phoenix creates these clusters out of the malicious traffic feed, then when we get new domain names, new resolutions coming in, not from malicious traffic, but from general traffic, we are able to pick up the ones that look malicious, automatically generated, and if they resolve to an IP address that we know belongs to a cluster, to a botnet, we are able to associate that. But if we don't know, if it's really new, we are unable to see that unless we run this priming phase on the malicious domains again. So we are depending basically on those domains ending up in the malicious domain list. Before that, we are unable to see new botnets, new clusters. And this is a serious limit that we wanted to overcome. So we created a larger system that we called Cerberus. And Cerberus is basically composed of a pre-processing step which uses Phoenix to create, to pre-populate a set of clusters of botnets. And then analyzes a stream of DNS resolutions of passive DNS data to figure out if there are passive DNS data related to the botnets we already know, and also if there are passive DNS data that are related to a botnet which we don't know about yet. And just as a reminder, when I say we already know, I mean we already figured out with Phoenix, so we already figured out the existence of that botnet from the data. There's nothing in Cerberus or in Phoenix where you, as an input, need to tell the system about a botnet. Whenever I show you a label saying Palivo or Zeus or whatever else, it means that afterwards, by doing quality control, I was humanly able to say, okay, good boy, this one was a botnet, and I tagged it personally. But it's not something that I tell the system. That's pretty much the point. This is all stuff we figure out, we divine out, only of the DNS traffic data. So we get, as you can imagine, if you get a passive DNS data stream, if it's a good feed, you get a lot of domain name resolutions. So we needed a way to skin down those resolutions to a manageable size. Because if you haven't figured it out, the amount of money that the universities can dedicate to computational power is not the same amount of money that OpenDNS, Google, or Microsoft can dedicate to computational power. It's a bit different. So we needed a quick way to filter those out. And filtering is based on insights. It's based on heuristics that we know will take out most of the benign stuff. So the first heuristic is actually very simple. If the domain name that has been resolved is listed in the Alexa top 1 million domains, it's very unlikely that it's a malicious domain. And in particular, it's very unlikely that it's a malicious domain that is being used for automatic generation of domains by a botnet. It could be a malicious domain, but it's a very well-established malicious domain. So that would actually be an interesting research question. Pick up the Alexa top 1 million list and say how many of those are not really benign websites. The second insight is that there are a lot of automatically generated domains that belong to things that need to automatically generate domain names. CDNs are the prime example. There's a few other technologies on the internet that automatically generate domain names, but this is the prime example. You will see a lot of these. So if it's a CDN, we trust people that run CDNs to be able to sort out their network security. This may be a big assumption, but we kind of do that. So we toss out those automatically generated domains because we know that they are automatically generated for a purpose. Some top-level domains require a clearance. If you want to register a domain in .mil or .edu, .gov in the US, or if you want to register a domain in some .uk, .it, you need to perform some additional steps of authentication. You cannot just go online and register it. So, well, in .it, currently you can. But it used to be different than that. So for those domains, we can safely assume that if someone is automatically generating domains and registering them at a volume of tens per week, they are not going to be bothered to use those domains. There's another insight that is particularly interesting. It comes from a Black Hat presentation that I pointed at down there. Basically, in the new world of fast flux networks, the domains have a time to leave that is actually larger than you would expect. It's usually larger than 300 seconds. This is done to save money, basically, to the malicious guys, because basically it costs less for them to run the infrastructure to herd the botnet. It's very, very consistent. If you pick up all of the botnets that are currently running automatically generated domains, they all use and register domains with time to live larger than 300 seconds. And so we filter according to this insight. Of course, the other insight is the one that we have already seen, right? We filter it with the same techniques that we used in Phoenix to filter out only domains that have been automatically generated. Why do we do this step? Among the other filters? Because of course, computing the distances is actually expensive. Computing the features is actually expensive. So if we can toss out things before actually resorting to computing distances, we can speed up the process. Another filter is based on a WIS query. We basically discard domains that have been registered for a long time. If you are looking for automatically generated domains that are disposable and are used for just one day, this makes total sense. Okay, and just to give you an idea of the number, if you pick up a random 50,000 resolutions, 20,000 of those have a TTL that is larger than 300 seconds. 19,000 of those are not in the Alexa top 1 million domain. 15,000 of those are not CDNs, so you drop other 4,000 just by looking at the CDNs. You drop it to 800 by filtering for it looks like automatically generated. You then discard a further 100 by looking at things that require previous authorization. and you discard some more, and you get with 300 that satisfy all of the criteria that we listed. So in a very quick and efficient manner, we can reduce 50,000 resolutions to 300. This is a randomly representative sample. So after we have done this filtering, we end up with domains that are suspected to be automatically generated and belonging to a botnet. How do we classify them? We classify them using basically our clustering algorithms to check if the string corresponds to the pattern of another string. And we also classify them on the base of the IP address that they have resolved to, because we have seen that the clicks are based on IP address and structure. So for instance, if we have the resolution that you see there on the right, 576.wap-whatever.net, which has resolved that IP address ending in 180, there's a couple of clusters that are both resolving to that IP address. Why is that? Because malicious guys share infrastructures. When they find an infrastructure that is actually stable, they share it, they use it for hosting multiple command and control channels. Resolution, we've, so humanly, I can tell that it should belong to cluster B. It looks like it came from the same origin as cluster B. How do I let the machine do that? I need to figure out a way to associate that based on the structure. This way, I will not dive into the mathematical details. We use a subsequent string kernel classifier. It's a technique that has been developed at Royal Holloway in 2002. Actually, this reminds me that I should point out that this research is done by Politecnico di Milano in conjunction with Royal Holloway, with the group of my good friend, actually childhood friend, Lorenzo Cavallaro, who is a professor at Royal Holloway. So the subsequent string kernel basically is a way to make strings that are structurally very similar cluster together. I will not drop into the details, but if you want to check out the details, there's a paper by the first author is Lodhi, and it was presented in 2002, and it's very interesting, but it's a few kilometers of mathematics, and I don't have the time this morning. But if you want, and if you're interested, we can dive into that later. In a separate room, shielded off from the others so that we don't contaminate these people. We use a support vector machine, which is basically a way to pick up things that have a few dimensions, embed them in a space that is larger, and the subsequent string kernel is exactly that. It's a way to make the distance between two strings explode in a space that has a number of dimensions. There I am. I'm actually explaining that without even wanting to do that. And then separating it. And basically, the idea of support vector machines is that you can cut with planes a space with a higher number of dimensions. And when you map it back to the real space, these planes will actually be curved lines. Because in splitting clusters, it is usually difficult to develop algorithms that do not split along very straight lines or very very specific curves. So a support vector machine is a way to trick data into allowing you to do that. I know a few people that could kill me for that definition, so don't tell that I told that. The results of Cerberus are actually pretty good. Basically, by running training and testing with manually labeled data, manually as in PhD student labeling them, we were actually able to have a very high overall accuracy. But the real interesting component of Cerberus is the fact that we are able to discover new botnets. And how do we do that? Well, you know, the key observation is that the botnet will need to update and to check into different domain names every day. So if we collect things, that look like automatically generated, but we were not able to associate to a cluster yet. We piled them up on the side. At some point, we will be able to say that that cluster is interesting. How can we do that? So the first thing is that we basically can look at the resolutions and group them by autonomous system. Why? Because the attackers are lazy, and if they find an interesting autonomous system that allows them to run their malicious infrastructure, they will stay there until you kick them out. So if we see something that keeps clustering the same autonomous system, then it's probably the same botnet. The other thing is that basically, if we see a click of domains that cluster to the same autonomous system and that are close to each other in the sense of those subsequences of strings, then since every day you need to generate one new item, and over the past, say, 7 days, I saw these 7 items that are close to each other and that are resolving to the same autonomous system, well, that's probably a cluster that is forming. And this is the key intuition behind the time detective. It sounds like a very basic intuition, and it also has one huge problem, and the huge problem is how do you actually cope with the fact that sometimes the lazy attacker moves their infrastructure to a different place? Well, you deal with that because when they move, you already have the 2 clusters, you already have the 2 sets of names. If you look at them and you say, okay, are these 2 sets of names actually overlapping? You can track those movements. And what we do is we use some more math that I can still explain in that soundproof room over there. And it's called the Welch test. And basically, the Welch test is an enormous mathematical tool that answers a very simple question. If I have this distribution of data and if I have this distribution of data, if I put them together, is this going still to be the same distribution? If it's going to be the same distribution, it means that those 2 clusters can be merged together. And this means that I can not only, you know, follow the clusters forming, but when the clusters are formed, I can merge them because they are in the same autonomous system, and then I can split them into their appropriate clusters because more than one botnet can run on the same system. So I'm skimming to the results. All of this, by the way, has been obtained by having data from Farsight, which is a startup in the DNS threat intelligence area, which we would like to thank. So if we run these algorithms for a little while, what happens? So the first thing that happens is that we have some domains in that traffic that we already know are malicious. And we can label them because we know they come from stuff that we know is malicious. Then, over a week, Cerberus generates several thousands of domains that are suspicious. We don't know what they belong to, but we think they might be a botnet. Then we run those algorithms that I've just described, and the results are that we are able to generate clusters that then manually, in order to check if what we did made sense, we were able to assign to those botnets. So once again, there's a label over there, but it's not in the data. We have provided the tool with just the DNS data. It came up with clusters, and then by looking at them manually, we said, okay, this is Palevo, this is Celity. These are the botnets that I was looking for. And this is an example of merging. It's Palevo that moved from a set of IP addresses to a very different set of IP addresses. But by looking at the domain, at the substrings of the domain names, we were able to say, okay, this is the same TGA, it just moved, so put them back together. So the recap is that we were able to detect and label 187 malicious domains. We were able to collect 3,500 more and to assign them to clusters that we don't yet know what the name is, but which is the point of doing intelligence on this data, figuring out that there is something interesting in that data to look at. So at the end of this operation, we ended up with 47 clusters of DGAs that were automatically discovered. And in the next 24 hours, by running this some more, 319 new domains were found and automatically associated to those clusters. So what happens is that when you run Cerberus, the more you run it, the more knowledge is accumulated in the system, and the more it is able to automatically do the work for you in the next few days. So the conclusions are that we were able to create a Cerberus system that discovers and characterizes unknown DGA-based activity based only on the input of domain data. You put in a pipe with passive domain data, passive domain resolution data, and you get out a pipe of clusters of botnets. It's unsupervised. It can be deployed easily. If you're not a university, in that case, you have a lot of paperwork to go through. And it is privacy preserving. It can be run on intelligence data. So if you want to have a challenge, that with this I will leave you. This is an easy way to evade the linguisticfilter.com. If you want to generate automatic domains that evade the Cerberus, you just need to pick words instead of picking letters. This is obviously something that they don't do because nobody would ever register a domain name this long, so you could just put a limit on the size of domains and figure them out. But you get my drill. If we deploy this and this is widely used, then since this is an adversarial field, the enemies will actually try to figure out ways to evade it. So if you want to help us, just figure out a way to evade it. And then if you want to help us more, figure out a way to counter the technique that you figured out to evade it. And with that, I thank you for your attention. And those are. And I will take questions offline in the same soundproof room where I can explain the mathematical details to you.
Thanks a lot, Stefan.